Hey folks, Rob Wolf here with Greg Everett. This is episode 82 of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Greg, what is cooking?
Oh man, just on a roll with the technical problems here today. So hopefully we have a full length podcast this time.
It's taken us 25 minutes to pull the plug on Go. And then we had kind of similar deal last week. And then unbeknownst to me, my recording stopped partway through, which didn't seem to affect the quality of the podcast at all, oddly enough. Rob can be there. He doesn't have to be there. It really doesn't affect the quality, so.
Oh, boy. Well, we're both just doing it for the love of reading emails.
Indeed. Indeed.
Which I have another 250 unread ones currently, so it's weird. They just keep coming in. It's almost like you're encouraging people to send you more emails.
It's weird. It's weird. So anything new, anything exciting that people need to know in the Catalyst Athletics universe?
No.
No.
No, and that means no, the DVD's not done yet.
Okay. I was trying to mix it up a little bit and, you know, jazzify that thing just a smidge. So,
pretty much every time we pop up somewhere, someone asks about the DVD and I have to hang my head in shame and admit that it's not done yet.
Well, at least that was less than the 6 years that I was, you know, making threatening gestures about a book. So,
yeah. Well, I just like to make the excuse that I haven't gotten it done because I'm busy actually coaching weightlifters instead of making movies, but I don't know if that's a legitimate excuse.
I'd run with anything you have, so.
All right. You ready for this one?
Let's do her.
All right, let's party. Sweet. Tom says, hi, I'm new to the paleo lifestyle, and as a polysomnography tech, I'm very pleased to see the emphasis on sleep in a dark room with avoidance of TV and computers before bed. I've been hearing some rumblings about electromagnetic radiation and sleep disturbances, but there's not much in my discipline's literature yet. What's your opinion on eliminating unneeded electronic devices such as clocks, cordless phones, and electric blankets from the bedroom?
Mm. This one is a good one that really skirts that lunatic fringe mainstream scene rather nicely. When folks have historically looked at electromagnetic radiation and its influences on biological systems, typically what they're looking at is ionizing radiation. Like, can you reach a point in which you start stripping away electrons off of organic molecules, in which you can get some free radical damage and stuff like that. And so all of this data has been really kind of dodgy to pin anything down. A couple of years ago, the British publication New Scientist had some pretty interesting information, basically indicating that strong magnetic fields, different types of electromagnetic radiation, instead of affecting ionizing elements of our body or creating, you know, reactive oxygen species via ionizing radiation, which they find is that a lot of our protein pores in our body and also our DNA are polar molecules, and that you can get some tweaks and changes in the way that, say, like our calcium or magnesium channels function in the various cells, the way that DNA folding can be influenced. So you have a much more subtle but definitely a real effect that can be wrought from this electromagnetic radiation. And the thing, again, this is similar to the visible spectrum of light. We're being exposed to levels of radiation that are just orders of magnitude greater than what we've ever really experienced in the past. And I think it just kind of makes sense to maybe not have, say, like a laptop computer sitting in your crotch, to not have a clock radio right next to your head. You know, the data on this, again, it's in that kind of borderline, you know, lunatic fringe kind of realm. But it seems to make some sense. Like, there's probably some stuff that you would be smart to consider, you know, trying to minimize your exposure to electromagnetic radiation via, you know, whatever variety, whether it's cell phones or computer screens, electric blankets, all that sort of stuff. Now, that said, if you're going to freeze to death, I would probably recommend the electric blanket. But, you know, I think there's something to this stuff. I think it's subtle. But I think it's additive, and I think in general, like, health and quality of life and everything is typically better to the degree that we kind of minimize electromagnetic radiation exposure. So not super scientific, but that's kind of my gut sense on that stuff. Okay, folks, so we're back. We had a little technical dealio there, but what would it be if we didn't? So here we go again.
It's the height of professionalism.
We do pretty well for being in two different time zones. So,
okay, let's see here. Nate says, "Hey guys, I got a quick question for you. I've noticed in some lab tests from my doctor that when I'm supplementing with creatine, about 3 to 5 grams a day, my creatinine levels increase. Nothing super high, just slightly above normal. I've experimented with this and removed the creatine from my diet, had another lab test, and the levels went back to normal. Should I be concerned about this? Should I stop taking creatine as a result? Thanks for the help."
No. Creatinine is a breakdown product of creatine. And folks hopefully are aware that, you know, creatine phosphate is part of the ATP energy generation system in our muscles and nerves and, you know, all that stuff. And so with somebody with larger muscle mass, somebody supplementing creatine, somebody who is eating a lot more red meat, you're going to get an influx of creatine, and then you're going to subsequently get an elevation of creatinine as a byproduct of that. Where people get freaked out about the creatinine levels is that it can be indicative, if creatinine levels go up, that there might be some problems with glomerular filtration in the kidneys, that there might be something funky going on there. But it, as a standalone item, that's not something to freak out about. And this is one of the problems with standard GFR analysis anyway, trying to track what kidney function is. Unless you're looking at, like, blood urea nitrogen and some other markers, it's really hard to pin down whether or not the creatinine is a byproduct of greater muscle mass or different dietary inputs. And it doesn't really paint a really accurate picture of the what kidney function is actually happening. And then as a baseline, creatine, and this is just one of those things. It's one of those supplements that are quite helpful for most people, has some beneficial effects on cardiovascular parameters, and is dirt cheap. So it's one of those rare supplements that I don't see any reason not to take it. Like, it definitely, there are some people who are non-responders, but even for the non-responders, it seems like a worthwhile item to take. So I wouldn't worry about the elevated creatinine levels unless this is part of an overall problematic picture, including elevated blood urea nitrogen levels and stuff like that.
And while we're on the topic, because I'm sure this will get brought up in the comments, are there any particular type of creatine that you recommend? Man. Monohydrate, phosphate, crealkaline, any of that stuff?
You know, the what's the cheap stuff? The monohydrate,
yeah.
where you get it for like $6 for a kilo?
Yeah.
You know, that seems to be good to go. I know everybody plays up all these other derivatives, but the basic deal is that the monohydrate is dirt cheap. Maybe you need to take a little bit more than the crealkaline or something like that. But I think the end result ends up being virtually identical. If you want to, you know, piggyback some stuff like the beta-alanine or some of these other kind of ATP, creatine phosphate intermediates, then that's certainly fine. But I would just go with the, you know, a good quality but inexpensive variety and just kind of roll from there. Jaro has some good stuff. Now Foods has good stuff. There's some good creatine products out there that are very inexpensive.
Yeah, my standby one is the NSI stuff, and it's something like $20 for a kilo. It's pretty much next to nothing.
Yeah, and then, you know, you can supplement aggressively 5 to 10 grams a day with that. You take some before training, take some before bed. There's some literature that if you take some creatine on an empty stomach before bed, it might enhance growth hormone production. So you're talking about a pennies per dose kind of supplement that seems to have some pretty good benefit almost regardless of what you're up to. Can cause some water retention, so if you're in a really tight weight class type of sport or something like that, that can be a consideration. If you're just starting to introduce it and the weather is getting warm, you want to provide some adequate, you know, hydration ramp up and stuff like that. But other than that, it's pretty mellow, but efficacious stuff.
Fantastic.
Indeed.
Next question. Dan says, Rob, I'm finishing up your solution book. Very informative. I've read two other paleo diet books and enjoyed yours the most. I appreciate your insight on inflammation. My question relates to my situation. I have 7mm L5, I think lower back pain radiates down left leg, disc herniation. I was doing CrossFit at the time of the injury, and then in parentheses says, I've had the injury for about 10 years, but it became painful again during a workout. So it sounds like this time CrossFit did not actually cause the injury, just a flare-up.
Just a flare.
So far, the only way to control the pain... Oh, man, there's so many jokes to go along with that one, but I'm just going to keep... I'm going to keep powering through this one. So far, the only way to control the pain is with rest, ibuprofen, and I just recently had an epidural injection into the inflamed area. The medicines work very well, but I'm afraid of the long-term effects. I would also like to be able to CrossFit again soon, but my doctor recommended I quit it for good. As was the cause of my flare-up, is there any food or recommendation on exercise you can recommend? I plan on taking a month off from CrossFit and doing yoga to strengthen my core and improve flexibility. Thanks for your time.
Standard anti-inflammatory diet, probably some... a little bit more aggressive on the fish oil for some anti-inflammatory, maybe a slight analgesic effect. But, you know, what, depending on how you've had sustained this injury, that's kind of where you need to go back and look at how you got injured, why you got injured. Like, was it tight hamstrings? Was it some poor movement? What was going on in the workout where you tweaked this thing again? I had never, ever, ever had a back problem in my life, and I feel horrible relating this story, but I worked as a physical therapy aide for years, and we would have people shuffle into the physical therapy clinic with low back pain, and they're like, you know, sucking air and gasping and pain, and I just couldn't believe it because I had been paralyzed playing football, had a compound fracture of my ulna and radius, boxer's fracture that didn't get set for almost 2 weeks. And I mean, this stuff hurt, but it nothing like what I saw these people expressing. And I was like, oh my God, these guys are just, you know, hypochondriacs or wimps, you know, whatever. And then I was at, the old, where it all started, CrossFit HQ in Santa Cruz, and did one workout one day that involved like 30 or maybe three sets of 30 glute ham developer sit-ups, which I had never done a single one prior to this.
Uh-oh.
Which, yeah, shocker. And so had compartmental syndrome, basically
abdo,
and distended belly, absolutely no ramp up, pretty typical introduction, you know, with the technology there. And so, I don't know, maybe 10, 12 days later, we were pulling a max effort deadlift, and I still was not firing my abs correctly. And somewhere about as I passed the knees, I didn't just lose a little bit of lumbar stability. Like, I just buckled under like 460 pounds of weight. And I immediately knew that I was hurt, like really, really bad. And sat down, everything started tightening up. I managed to limp out to my car. I was actually doing some work in Santa Cruz at the time, drove back to my apartment, and it took me 45 minutes to crawl from my car to my apartment. And I was whimpering like a little baby the whole time. And so I definitely had some karmic payback for the fun that I had made of all the people with the low back pain. And the whole point of this meandering, like, senile story is just that ever since then, I've had predisposition to tweak my back. I did some back squats about 15 days ago, 14, 15 days ago. Inadequate warm-up, tight hip flexors and quads. And I did not get out of position, but just the fact that I didn't warm up enough and the fact that my quads were a little tight, they yanked down on my pelvis, and I got kind of a extension or kind of a hyperextension injury. And so it's you need to really figure out like what you did and then figure out what are the orthopedic things that you need to do to fix that. And one of the problems that I see with CrossFit as it's generally practiced is that you're doing some movements that can be really dodgy under exhaustion and load. Versus, like, there's a bunch of stuff, shuttle runs, bear crawls, even stuff like kettlebell swings and stuff like that seem to lend themselves better to quasi-exhaustive movement versus, say, like a heavy thruster, a heavy back squat, high rep deadlifts and stuff like that. Like deadlifts over 3 reps at this point are just not in the program for me. Like if I want to get a back tweak, that is just absolutely begging for it for me because of the way it ends up loading my hamstrings and stuff like that. So that's all, you know. So on the nutrition side, standard anti-inflammatory diet, you might play with some bromelain, Wobenzyme, taking about 20 tablets of Wobenzyme per hour in an acute phase of an injury. This is straight out of the Charles Poliquin kind of protocol. That stuff is all helpful, but, you know, you've got a pre-existing injury. You need to really get in and do some analysis and figure out why you got hurt originally and what the precipitating elements are that can bring this thing about now. And that's going to be the only way that you can keep doing this stuff. And then, you know, if you want to get back in, if you want to do sport of fitness type stuff and be competitive, I guess that's kind of one thing. And then, you know, this is the realm of heading into like kind of professional athletics. Like, is this super important to you such that you need to do the full repertoire that, you know, makes up CrossFit, sport of fitness type stuff? Or do you simply like getting a time-effective workout that is more strength endurance oriented? And in that case, then program intelligently with the idea in mind that you're going to work around your injury and not re-injure yourself. So figure out what your movement limitations are, the orthopedic limitations. Do you have some neurological faults that aren't being addressed? And then work around that. And again, you know, stuff like boxing, kickboxing, sandbag drills, sprinting, bear crawls, all of that stuff is very good metabolic conditioning and can be very fun, can be very, very challenging, but lends itself much, much better to like kind of orthopedic considerations versus some things like high rep deadlifts, you know, super fatigue thrusters and stuff like that. What do you think on that, Greg?
Yeah, I would just echo everything you just said, basically. And there's really no reason you can't do CrossFit style training. You just have to do the smart style of CrossFit training. And so like Rob said, you need to figure out kind of what the precipitators are, what caused it originally, what kind of movement position, et cetera. And then, you know, obviously your intention to strengthen your core and improve your flexibility, you're on the right track, but be cautious about how you approach that because yoga can get pretty weird sometimes. A lot of instructors are not super keyed into what's going on with individual people and have a tendency to kind of push you past what might be smart. So whoever you're working with, make sure you tell them about your disc herniation and hopefully they're intelligent enough and experienced enough to know how to work around that so you can actually get some benefit out of it and not kill yourself.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't mean to pick on yoga folks. That's true for any instructor of anything, but just be vocal about that and don't get yourself into a position, so to speak, where you're going to get pushed into something that you're not really prepared for.
So kind of the long and short, you know, figure out how you got hurt, and then that's going to really give you some directives about how you don't get hurt again. And you may very well need to modify a lot of the programming elements. The high rep deadlift I used to really like, and man, I don't anymore.
Do not want.
yeah, don't like.
Yeah, yeah. The most I ever have anybody do is fives, and that's pretty rare.
And even with those, if we have folks do them now, we do them cluster style where folks will pull it, return it to the deck, reset, pull it, return it to the deck, reset. You know, we're really not bouncing the deadlift anymore, which it's an interesting thing because there's been all kinds of hyperbole around that. And I used to actually be a fairly staunch defender of the somewhat ballistic deadlift, but not anymore. I was 100% wrong on that. So,
oh, Trust me, you and I have made a few mistakes in the past.
And we'll make more than our fair share again.
All right.
Hopefully fewer in the future than we've made in the past, though.
Well, just, I don't know if it has to be fewer to make me satisfied. It just has to be different ones.
Yeah, yeah.
Then I'll feel fine about myself. You can't claim I didn't learn anything if I don't repeat the same mistake. So, all right. David says, what are the best remedies for osteoarthritis? I'm a 39-year-old convert feeling the effects of silly past weightlifting habits. I'm currently taking glucosamine, chondroitin, and generally eating a paleo diet. Not as strict as I could be. I also practice intermittent fasting regularly, 16 to 18 hours of fast per day. Any advice you could give would be appreciated. And this is specifically osteoarthritis in the wrist via the subject line.
So, you know, if David's getting some amelioration of symptoms with the glucosamine, then we've got a gluten problem here. It's just, like, guaranteed. We understand pretty clearly that glucosamine is actually occupying some receptor sites that kind of block the inflammatory action of gluten. And so, self-admittedly, even in the, the information here that the diet is not as strict as it could be. So, wackily enough, I'm going to recommend that you really tackle this anti-inflammatory diet really aggressively for 30 days. And from there, you know, usually our osteoarthritis is either somebody who's been performing at a very high level well, but a lot of it, or not well. Like the orthopedics are not there. The biomechanics are not there. It's kind of like if you're driving your car and you whack a wheel on a curb and you're out of alignment, those tires that should have lasted 70,000 miles are going to last 7. And so that's where I, you know, if it's in the wrist, then I'm thinking like maybe some impact injuries, maybe some impingement between the way that the ulna radius articulates around itself, possibly some elbow impingement and stuff like that. Probably doing some sniffing around over at the Mobility WOD archives and seeing what type of assessments are floating around out there for elbow extension parameters, and then also ulna radius. Normal tracking would be good. And it kind of work proximal, close to the body, and then work your way down distal to the actual injury site. So that's the stuff that I would fix. Fix the diet. Make that 100% solid. Make sure you're taking plenty of vitamin D so that that's modulating inflammation also. And then look at orthopedic issues that could potentially go on. And if you've got crappy form on something, for the love of God, fix it. You know, especially if you're doing some sort of high motor unit activity, tennis, softball, CrossFit type stuff where you're doing a lot of repetitious movement. If the mechanics aren't good, then you're going to wear through that stuff quicker. So that's the, I think, kind of the main way that you want to tackle that.
That sounds great to me. I have nothing else to contribute to that.
Cool. You might have a bit to contribute on this next one, though.
Yeah. I just like the subject line, which is, where did the hang power clean come from? Well, you see, Nick, sometimes when a hang clean and a power clean love each other...
they get together and make a baby.
All right. So Nick says, this question is directed towards Greg, not that Rob doesn't know his ish. I have not seen that word.
Rob knows ish.
I was practicing hang power cleans on one of the two Oli platforms at my local Globo gym. I know, right? Bumpers and all. Oh, but don't drop the weight from above waist high. I've seen better. I trained a guy in a gym up in Bend, Oregon, where the weightlifting, well, weight space lifting room was upstairs on what seemed to be some kind of particle board and rice paper floor. And they had nice. They had a couple pairs of bumpers, but no platforms anywhere and no bars that rotated. It was very confusing to me. One of the guys who I see there frequently, a seemingly intelligent lifter, collegiate wrestler with more than adequate form from what I can tell, questioned why I was shorting the squat in my hang clean. I explained that I was practicing hang power cleans, and with a puzzled look on his face, he presented me the two variations of the cleans he was aware of. The hang clean, with a full squat from the hang position, and the power clean, from the floor, no squat after the catch. While I know I'm not crazy that the hang power clean has been taught to others, or by others, Mike Bergner's video come to mind, I had no explanation of why we might practice the hang power clean, what its benefits over the other two movements, hang clean and power clean. It's never been explained to me, although it's been prescribed. I made a guess and said it was helping me practice that specific pulling motion from the dip without taxing myself in a full squat. But being a person who doesn't like to talk about something he really doesn't understand, I qualified that with, honestly, dude, I have no idea. So can you help me understand why one would prescribe the hang power clean movement to an athlete / trainee? What are its pros, cons versus the other two targeted movements, hang clean / power clean? Would love your input. So yes, you're not crazy. Hang power clean is a legitimate exercise. Basically, anytime you're doing a lift from the hang, there are a couple basic reasons you might do that. First is that it's easier technically for most people. You just get rid of all the problems associated with the first pull, you know, navigating past the knees, keeping that posture, all that stuff. So if you can start to lift from the knee above the knees or higher, then it's going to be much easier. And that's why I and a lot of people teach the lifts initially from the hang. With a more advanced lifter who's not so much concerned with technical issues, the hang work is more to force a better rate of force development. So in other words, you shorten the distance that lifter has to accelerate the bar, and they have to accelerate it faster and harder. So same idea as pulling things from the blocks. It's a shorter distance, so you've got to produce more force in less time. And, you know, a power clean, whether you're taking it from the floor or the ground, can be used for a number of reasons. One would be to have kind of a lighter weight clean variation for whatever reason. If you are kind of saving your legs or letting your legs recovery from or for a real heavy squatting day, for example, you can also use power stuff to kind of encourage more speed at the top of the pull, a faster turnover, things like that. So the combination of the hang and the power is basically just a combination of all those factors. So, you know, you might have a beginner doing a hang power clean because you don't want to worry about the first pull yet, and maybe their flexibility is limited and they can't do a full depth clean yet. So you're still teaching the mechanics of the movement, but you're just limiting to what they're capable of doing at that point. For someone who's, again, not working on technical stuff, then the hang power clean still has got plenty of utility, and you're basically you're now getting that the rate of force development part taken care of. So you're starting from a higher position, you have less time to accelerate, but then also you've got to get that bar higher and get under it faster because you've got to receive it higher and stop it. So obviously, you know, if you take those three variations, the hang clean, the power clean, and then the hang power clean, you'll see a decreasing amount of weight that's able to be used in that order. Simply because of what I've talked about before. So,
Greg, would you say that, say, like, for like generalist athletic population, hang power clean might be your maximum benefit, minimum investment item?
Absolutely.
To use?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no question. And I mean, especially when it comes to snatching, like a great example is the two football players I had in here right before we started recording this. They've been doing power cleans from the floor, but they've been doing power snatches only from the hang because I only had, you know, 9 weeks with them or whatever it was, you know, once a week. And that was the most kind of effective thing we could do with as little time as we had. And, you know, we're not going to get these guys super flexible one day a week in 9 weeks and have them, you know, doing snatches from the floor. So, yeah, doing stuff from the hang is super easy to teach. That's where most of the benefit from those lifts come for non-weightlifter athletes, which I think we talked about that in a previous podcast. That seems familiar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Maybe 3 or 4 ago. So yeah, it's a good way to start. And the thing too, is that if you're teaching it right, which you should be, it's very easy to come back later and add on that pull from the floor.
Right.
There shouldn't be any complications there. If someone can pull well or can lift well from the hang, and then you teach them how to pull from the floor, well, magically you have that full pull taken care of. So,
and I'm not 1/10 the O-lifting coach that Craig is, but the stuff that I've typically done with our folks is get them competent on like a hang power clean, and then usually wrap up that session with clean pulls to work that full pull that transitions into a dynamic extension that would complement that whole thing, and we might load it, say, like 105, 110% of what they were doing on the Hang Power Clean. And it's really a very, very short, easy learning curve. And if you got somebody who is tall, has funky levers, if they're mainly just looking at doing this stuff for athletic development, like this is a lot of the stuff that we've done with our MMA folks and stuff like that, you get some really, really nice development, very minimum risk of injury, and minimal frustration for both the coach and the athlete. They succeed very quickly, and possibly more important than that, oddly enough, is that they see immediate benefit to their sport. So
yeah, it's a good choice. So don't get pressured into doing something you're not ready to do yet, Nick.
And Greg, just as a point of clarification, the Hang Clean and the Power Clean, those, or the Hang Clean, that would be a squat clean?
Yes, that would be a full squat clean.
Not a partial squat
clean. You may actually want to squat to a medicine ball to make sure you're achieving full depth.
Indeed.
To be safe.
Indeed.
Of course.
Especially if you're a small female who's about 4'3".
Yes. Well.
Because then you're barely, you're not even breaking parallel in that case, but yeah, you're touching some object.
It's a good idea no matter who you are.
Yeah.
Got to have standards. Okay. The smaller girls, you guys, you can use a 6-pound ball. The big tall guys, you can use a 20-pounder.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. This next one I like for primarily just how it was written, but it actually is kind of an interesting thing to me because there's something in here that I know you've touched on in the past, and I think if you don't bring it up, I'll remind you.
Perfect.
Roland says, "Dear Rob and Greg, how are you? I am fine. I know that many people merely can't eat enough to grow without all that carbage, but is muscle growth actually more efficient with a higher carb percentage? Have a bitchin' summer." Awesome.
Oh, man. I would say without a doubt, you generally are going to see some better overall muscle mass gains with a higher carb intake. But that's with the caveat kind of around, you know, what's your carb tolerance. Like, I seem to do pretty well on a low-ish carb, like kind of cyclic low carb, but, you know, I just kind of have to stair-step that stuff. But I would say to the degree that you generally tolerate carbs, you'll probably do better on that. Although, you know, like Matt Lalonde and I have kicked this thing around. He's mentioned it before where we, you know, like quasi-ketogenic kind of scene, really driving the fat calories and whatnot. The problem with the legitimate low-carb approach is twofold. One, you bottom out on how much your body can deal with fat. You just end up shitting like a goose at some point. You get steatorrhea, your body can't deal with the fat intake, and so you hit a caloric ceiling that you can't really bump past. And also the ketogenic diet or high protein, high fat is so satiating, you are just flat not hungry. And so that's where mixing in as much carbs as you can to maximize caloric intake, maximize kind of some nutrient partitioning with some insulin spiking, then you're going to get better results with that. And there's no one size fits all with that. It's very dependent on who you are, what your sleep is, your kind of androgen levels are very influential on that, your thyroid levels. So I tend to drive people a little bit more on the low carb side of things just to kind of see how their metabolic machinery is working, and then we'll kind of titrate up from there and see where we can go.
So what this one made me think of is I know in the past you've talked about or you've encouraged people to kind of get a little leaner before they embarked on a bulking diet. Reason being kind of getting yourself set to be better at putting on muscle. So you want to explain that real quickly?
Yeah, and you know, I got to throw some props out to John Berardi for this. I think he was the first one that I really read this concept from, and it really both makes sense and it is supported by the literature that if you get a little bit leaner, say like for guys, you get say like 8 to 10% body fat, females, usually the weight gain deal isn't all that big a driver, so I'm not really going to focus on that. But, you know, you get guys a little bit leaner. Like, you don't want to go into a bulking phase already having love handles. You don't want to go into it already metabolically deranged, because we've got a situation as our fat mass increases, we aromatize testosterone into estrogen. We can get a whole host of problems that pop up out of that. It, you know, obviously, at the end of the day, really the efficacy of your bulking protocol is going to have less to do with the weight training you do, less to do with the food that you eat, and more to do with your hormonal status. People who have really good hormonal signaling naturally or exogenously via supplementation, it doesn't matter so much what you eat. And so, or really so much how you lift to some degree, you know, until you get it to very, very high levels of development. So if you're a natural lifter and you're really wanting to get your ducks in a row and get the most out of this thing, it just behooves you to be lean, because you're going to tend to produce growth hormone better. You're not going to aromatize testosterone into estrogen. Your insulin signaling is going to be good. And so everything's, once you start hyper feeding that system, things are going to be stacked as effectively for you as you can possibly get. But you know, there again, you still want to have the genetics like of our ART practitioner, John Fergoso. Like, the dude puts muscle on muscle. Like, it's just freaking disgusting.
Seriously, dude, that guy has six packs on his biceps.
Yeah, yeah. And he has great genetics, really good hormonal signaling. He responds to training like a beast, super fast twitch. So that's where just having super good parents or a great mule coming out of Central America is a really smart thing to do in that case.
Yes. All right. So, speaking of low carb, Renee says, "Hey, Rob and Greg, I'm a reformed CrossFitter, recently turned weightlifter, and have been a little stymied by the process of cutting weight for meats. Considering the standard recommendation is pull out carbs, it doesn't seem like it would be very effective for people that are already pretty low carb. I tried to drop weight for my second meet back on May 1st and started 2 kilos over a month out, but failed pretty epically. I was 3 kilos over 3 days before the meet and didn't want to go crazy with saunas, etc. Are there any non-extreme methods that would be more effective for the paleo folks? Pertinent details, 25-year-old female, currently walking around at 78 to 79 kilos, shooting to compete as a 75, around 27% body fat. Always struggle to lose weight, though. I was 109 at my heaviest when I was an untrained slob. Been in the high 70s for a year and a half or so. Training 3 times a week, eating 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight. Calories usually work out to 1,900 to 2,100. Usually half a sweet potato in the morning, green veggies throughout the day, asparagus, Brussels sprouts are my carb sources. Plantains deep fried in coconut oil are a recent addition and obsession. No major autoimmune problems, currently legume, nut, grain free. Dairy sneaks into the mix in the form of grass-fed butter. Thoughts? Thanks, guys." And then there's a face with a tongue sticking out sideways.
And she said, hopefully the subject line was interesting enough for Greg to pull it out, which obviously...
Well, it said weightlifters, isn't it?
Exactly. Well, dude, why don't you take a... Do you want to take a crack at this first? Like, what's your thoughts on this?
Sure. So, it's a tricky one. I mean, if you already have trouble losing weight, I mean, obviously you've lost 30 kilos or so, so that's a pretty damn good start. But what I would say is that if you really want to compete as a 75, you need to walk around closer to 75 the rest of the time, simply because you're obviously in a position where it's a little tougher than normal to lose weight. So unless you're maintaining, 1 to 2 kilos over that you can drop relatively quickly and easily, you're going to really struggle like this. So for example, the 175 kilo girl I coach, I tell her that I don't want her more than like 76.5, because she's had trouble like this in the past. And since we've kind of implemented that rule, she's had no trouble at all. Yeah, aside from that, like, you're going to have to take it as a long-term approach and get that weight down overall. And then beyond that, because you are low carb, you can't do that quick little fix. You probably are going to have to kind of just manipulate water intake and hydration in general, maybe even with some changes to salt intake. And so Rob's little hyperhidrosis deal would probably be a good thing to experiment with. And I'm going to have him explain that in just a second here. But just as an example, one of my guys and good friends, Mike Gray, competed at a meet last weekend as a 94 and did the hyperhidrosis thing, came down from about 96.5, ate 3 square meals the day before the meet, and you know, actually drank a bit of coffee too. So it definitely can take off a couple kilos without making you feel horrible and without having the psychological and physical draining effects that doing jumping jacks in a sauna for 2 hours can have.
Yeah. And this, and you know what, I think we've been calling it the wrong thing because we've called it hyperhidrosis for ages, but we actually have a legit hyperhidrosis question today. So, you know what it is. And I detailed this in, the fight prep, article that I did for the performance menu years ago, but basically what our fluid intake kind of dictates the production of this hormone, antidiuretic hormone, and antidiuretic hormone. So what this hormone does is it prevents the loss of water. If we suppress the production of this hormone, then our normal state will be diuresis. We will tend to shed water. And so what we do on this hyper, I don't even know the proper term because I know we've been saying the wrong thing here. Hyperhidrosis sounds cool. So what you're doing is about 5 to 6 days out from an event, and this will vary depending on how big you are. Bigger people will need a little bit more water, but we're taking in about 4 liters of water, about a gallon or more of water per day. And this is at a baseline. Like if you're in a hot, dry environment, then it's going to need to be more than that because you should probably be taking in about that much water anyway. But basically what we're doing, we're taking in enough water that we are suppressing the production of antidiuretic hormone. And the body starts compensating with that, and you're peeing like crazy. And about 5 days out, you're say like 4 to 6 liters, and then 4 days out, you're 4 to 6 liters. 3 days out, you're maybe 3 liters. 2 days out, it basically stair steps down such that you have several days of very high water intake, which suppresses the antidiuretic hormone production, and then you dramatically curtail water intake right up at the event. And what's happening there is that your body is kind of naturally shedding water, but you're allowing your kidneys to kind of do what they do with regards to balancing potassium, sodium ratios and stuff like that, and it does it more effectively than if we're using something like Lasix or some other sort of pharmaceutical diuretic. And then we should be able to rebound off of that. And what we can do is kind of shrink wrap people down, but without the dangers of using a pharmacological diuretic. So that's the hyper hydrating protocol. That's what we probably really should be calling that thing. And so that's a way to go with this. But, checking out the data here, the 27% body fat, it sounds like you've made a good a push at decreasing body fat levels. But personally, I would just devote some time to leaning out more, and that may involve maybe a little bit more high volume training, maybe a little bit of metabolic work, some work capacity stuff, maybe popping, punctuating caloric intake a little higher at certain points, and some carbohydrate intake a little higher. If you've been real low carb for a long time, might need to mix things up a little bit. But I would really like to see a gal running more like 17 to 19% body fat at the minimum if we want to really be competitive in the lifts. And then it's hopefully we're still running around at that right around 75 kilos. And so what we've done is probably added several kilos of muscle in the process, which is going to do nothing but improve the performance.
Yeah, I kind of glossed over that 27%. So that's a really good point. You could definitely get a little leaner, which will make the whole process easier. And yeah, with the whatever hydration protocol you want to call it, definitely experiment with that at a time other than going into a meet.
Game day.
And that'll give you an idea of how much it's going to help you lose and how you feel, and you can kind of tweak accordingly.
Yeah.
And then
– and that Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, right after you weigh in, you've got to start rehydrating pretty aggressively. And you've got to take care of any of the electrolytes as well. So, you know, coconut water, or if you want to do water and add salt and fake salt, potassium chloride, then you can just kind of bop in, like, I think it's something like a quarter teaspoon per liter or something like that. And coconut water is a little tastier for most people. Or you can get Pedialyte, indeed, which is delicious.
Woohoo! Pure glucose.
And I
too,
do think it's technically now, it's officially illegal to start an IV, even if it's just saline.
Oh, lifting gigs. Yeah.
Unfortunately, that one's out, but that would be ideal.
Cool. So if you do some tinkering with that, it'd be great to hear, you know, how are you tackling, say, like a body composition shift? If you do some fiddling with the hyperhydration protocol, you know, how does that play out?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this.
And now to our misstep, our misquote that comes back to us.
So this this email subject line was, "I'm so wet." And
hyperhydrosis.
Clearly, I looked at that email. Indeed. Dan says, "Hi, Rob/Greg. Please excuse the subject line. I just heard Greg say that it helps to have something that stands out. Hopefully that did the trick." Yes, Dan, good thinking.
Indeed it did.
Quick question for you. "I've always suffered from hyperhidrosis of the hands and feet. Any pseudoscientific thoughts on this condition and possible remedies? I know paleo isn't a cure-all, but it's really the only biological aspect that I haven't seen any improvement in a while, adhering very strictly to the paleo approach for the past 13 or 14 months. No other medical conditions to speak of. The book was awesome and the podcast is great. I'm grateful for all that you do."
You know, digging around on this condition, there can be some kind of parasympathetic, acetylcholine kind of driven type things, like just being wound a little too tight, if for lack of a better term. That can be an element of it. There are some autoimmune elements to the hyperhidrosis, Graves' disease, in which elevated cortisol starts causing some problems with thyroid levels, and all of that kind of causing a feed forward, elevated body temperature, kind of ramped up sympathetic nervous system. So if you've tackled all of that stuff via the food, like you've been adhering to the food, and we're still not really seeing some improvements, the things that I would check out, I would get some blood work and see if you might have some Graves' disease, and that's just kind of an outside possibility. And then the other side of this, I would get in and look at, like, some of this, I think we talked about this maybe the last podcast, transcendental meditation, some biofeedback, like anything that you can do that will help kind of down-regulate that sympathetic nervous system, just kind of like tone things down a little bit. Interestingly enough, I've seen some pretty good benefit from some acupuncture with some of that stuff too. So those are the things that go into it. It's definitely got a strong kind of neurochemical component, but also can be precipitated by problems like autoimmunity. And then from there, we're just if all of those ducks are in a row and all that seems okay, then we need to start looking at the neurological elements, like being overly, you know, wound up and doing something that can kind of wind that stuff down. And the biofeedback is amazing. There are some really good smartphone apps that can help you get that stuff wired in. Like, it can link up with your breathing and some other kind of metrics of your physiology and help you kind of dial things down. Some relaxation monitors via like iPhone or like Android app or something like that. But then I guess you're back into an electromagnetic field, so.
You just got to sleep on a tinfoil pillow.
There you go. There you go.
Taken care of. Cool. Well, we made it.
Technical gaffes and everything.
I did not think we were going to get through this one.
This was a rough week for Greg. So the Friday seemed to bring it all to a head. So we're lucky we even got this one on the books.
Yes. All right. Well, I got a whole week to recoup and get ready.
Sweet.
Hopefully, between now and then, my computer does not explode.
So we should be seeing an appearance by Chris Kresser soon. He's got cool thing cooking that we're going to talk to him about. We're going to get Kurt Harris on the show. I've got kind of a wacky life situation that popped up that I can't say too much about, but I was in LA for that, and I'll be telling folks more about that over time as contracts and legal things get hashed out with it. So that'll be pretty interesting, possibly horrifying too. We'll see. So,
oh man, that is so suspenseful.
It'll all make sense when you guys hear about it. So,
yeah.
I still don't know what I'm talking about, but I guess we'll do the best we can.
All right. Well, let's quit while we're ahead.
Awesome, G. Thanks,
okay,
man.
See ya.
Take care.